This is an Equity Mates Media podcast.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Equity Minds!
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is you.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast that follows our journey of investing. Whether you're an absolute beginner or approaching Warren Buffett status, our aim is to break down your barriers from beginning to dividend. My name is Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How are you going?
I'm very good, Bryce. I'm very excited for this episode. We've got one of our favorite expert investors returning to the podcast, I think for a third time.
Yeah, it's big.
And, you know, we're going to cover a lot in this episode, but yeah, I'm excited to get stuck in.
It's our absolute pleasure to welcome good friend of the show, Paul Wilson. Paul, welcome to Equity Mates.
Hi, Bryce. Hi, Ren. It's great to be back chatting to you guys. There's been a lot happening since the last time.
A lot happening, yeah. And we always find we walk away from these conversations with you feeling very inspired about investing. So looking forward to understanding what's been happening at Baylor Door over the last few months and a couple of the big deals that you've been doing. But for those who are unaware of Paul, Paul is the co-founder and partner at Baylor Door Technology Investments. The ASX ticker is BTI. They specialize in investing capital in fast-growing Australian businesses. In today's conversation, we're going to look at the Baylor Door portfolio, take a closer look at two specific case studies, and then pick Paul's brains on the vibrant and successful startup scene here in Australia. So let's crack in.
Yeah. So Paul, we want to cover a lot of ground in this conversation, but I think we have to start with the past 18 months because it's been a fascinating 18 months watching Baylor Door from the outside. Your share price was cut in half in the early days of the pandemic and has since jumped up 165%, meaning it's blown past its pre-COVID levels and it's up 35% since the start of 2020. So if we start pretty general, what have you learned about markets and about Baylor Door's portfolio companies in the past 18 months?
Well, I guess it was mainly a reinforcement for us that you have to expect that there's going to be turbulent conditions along the way, and you have to be able to withstand that without relying on the market always being there. I think I might have said to you guys before, you shouldn't invest based on an expectation of perfect execution. It's why we focus on the fundamentals of a business much more than the market ups and downs. So every time we invest, we assume that the business is going to have some ebbs and flows and that we're going to be involved for a number of years and be involved through some of those ebbs and flows. So for us, the foundations are always compelling product market fit, established customer base with predictable revenue, broad customer base if possible, solid business model with high margins, and perhaps most importantly, a great management team who can adapt. So that's why we really carefully select our portfolio. We look at hundreds of opportunities for each investment we make. We were concerned, as just about everyone was, with the unknown as we went into lockdowns. But we weren't super surprised that our portfolio companies have all performed quite well. They were set up for success. They had plenty of cash runway and that important factor that I mentioned of great management teams who could adapt. So more of a reinforcement for us.
Over the last sort of 18 months, you mentioned there, Paul, some of the key characteristics that you look for in investments. But have you had to change your approach to, I guess, how often you're investing, how many deals you're willing to do over the last sort of 18 months? Has your approach changed at all?
No, I don't think so. As I say, I think it was more of a reinforcement of our investment approach rather than a change, and just a realization that you can take advantage of these situations as well. Some of the companies that we're involved with have been able to expand their markets. Some have thrived. We've been able to get some realizations and then make a new investment as well.
So, Paul, you know, we touched on the action that the Bailador share price has seen, but behind the scenes, inside the company, there's also been a lot of action as well. You've sold positions in three investments, DoxCorp, Viostream, and Lendi. One of your portfolio companies, Stakla, merged with a Norwegian business. And in case you weren't busy enough, you also raised $24 million for Bailador as well. Can you just talk about the changes and, I guess, how you're positioning Bailador for the next stage of growth?
Absolutely. So those transactions that you mentioned were great examples of our business model and approach. We achieved solid returns. So in the case of DoxCorp, it was 30% IRR. Lendi was 21% IRR. Happy management teams. Those cash realizations proved out the model to the market. They enabled us to pay a 1.4 cents per share fully franked dividend. So that was our second fully franked dividend. It's also allowed us to focus on some new investments. So I think it's a good example of the life cycle of our fund and our business model. We'll hold these companies for a number of years. We'll realize them for a multiple of what we paid, and then we'll recycle that cash. While maintaining the portfolio, it's somewhere between 8 and 12 companies. That's about where we feel we can do our best work and add some value.
So just on the model that you speak of there, Paul, and for those that may be listening to you for the very first time, you know, in our previous conversations, you've stressed that Bailador's philosophy of carrying investments at conservative valuations is so that you can then surprise investors with the upside when you exit. So are you able to talk to that a little? And then also, I guess the question is, has that actually played out in some of the transactions that you've just mentioned?
Yes, it certainly did. So all three of those cash realizations were at values above our carrying value and quite substantially so. So DoxCorp, we sold for a valuation 53% higher than we'd been carrying it at. Lendi was 21% higher than we'd been carrying it at. So that makes 8 cash realizations now and 24 third-party transactions in the portfolio. And I'm really proud to be able to say that all of them have been at or above our carrying value. David Kirk and I set out from the beginning to be conservative in what we say to the market and in setting expectations. And we think it's really important to surprise on the upside. We think it's the right thing to do, and we intend to keep doing that.
Yeah, I think it's a smart game to play because we all know what happens when you don't surprise the market on, and when it comes to beating expectations. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting philosophy and approach to the portfolio.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Paul, if you weren't busy enough with exiting positions, you've also been looking at the market for new positions, and One investment that you've made is in Instant Scripts. So let's start at the beginning, because before we were preparing for this interview, I actually hadn't heard of Instant Scripts. So tell us about the company. What does it do? And I guess what's Bailador's investment thesis?
Sure. I love talking about Instant Scripts. It's a really exciting business. First of all, it starts by solving a problem that's been experienced by a lot of consumers. And that is, if they want to get a script, often it's a repeat script and they know exactly what they need, but they still have to go through the rigmarole of making an appointment with the GP, going and parking the car or catching public transport, then sitting in the waiting room until the GP is ready to see them, and then having a chat about perhaps things that aren't relevant to what you really want, just to get a script to go and get filled when you knew that's what you needed all along. And so that's the problem that's being solved. The way it's being solved is consumers can go onto the app or through the web interface and answer a series of questions that are appropriate for a particular prescription. And we cover the 400 Schedule 4 drugs that are non-addictive. Once those questions are answered, that goes to a real-time live GP who ticks off, yes, you can have that script. And the consumer can do that whole exercise within minutes and have a script that they can get filled at any chemist. So you can do it while you're at the pharmacy. You can do it from home and pick it up later. And there is a service you can have it delivered to your home. And so it's really such a great experience compared to the rigmarole of how it was historically done. And it's a real light bulb moment for lots of consumers the first time they use it. I know it was for me, and I know it was for my wife. She said, this is great. I'm going to do this from now on. And there's been over 100,000 Australians who've had that same experience. And so Instant Scripts is thriving. It's growing tremendously well. And one of the other things we like is that it benefits the whole medical community, because it just takes out a lot of the time that GPs would otherwise spend on these routine repeat type situations, and they can then spend that time solving more complex medical issues.
Yeah, I can certainly see a use case for this. It's often, you know, frustrating having to go to fill out that process of getting a script when you just really need to go and get a pretty simple box of tablets from the pharmacy or whatever it may be. It's a pretty annoying process. I guess the question is, Paul, like, what's the moat for this company? Where does it sit in the competitive landscape? Why can't sort of chemists just do this? Or, you know, I imagine that, and this is probably going to be a naive question, but the tech behind it is pretty easy to replicate. So, yeah, can you talk us through that?
Sure, happy to. So first of all, our thesis is that there will be more than one player involved in this segment. We don't think it's a winner-take-all type situation. We think the Instant Scripts management team really understands the community and the market. It's founded by Dr. Asher Frelick, a medical doctor who also had experience in investment banking, spotted the pain point, knew the opportunity for a solution, and has executed super well. It's something that has the support of pharmacy. So I don't think pharmacies are typically looking to go out and employ their own coders to make a product. But if someone comes up with something that makes sense for them, they'll get on board. And so more than 40% of the pharmacies in Australia have already registered on the Instant Scripts platform and are very happy to support it. And so we think the opportunity is big, firstly in that core area that I've described, but there's similar experiences in pathology. There's similar experiences in cosmetic clinics, so people looking for Botox and the like. That still needs a doctor's prescription, even though we all know it's the nurses who are doing the bulk of the work. And so there's lots of other applications in the Australian market, as well as potentially overseas, and we're assessing those at the moment.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating, and it is solving a real problem, and you know, a real inconvenience, I guess, for consumers. And I think, you know, the last 18 months with the pandemic, we've seen telehealth and telehealth-related businesses become a real growth area of the market. But a lot of that has been out of necessity because of lockdowns and people being uncertain about leaving the house, I guess. When you think about this consumer shift post-pandemic, what gives you confidence that, you know, people aren't just going to want to return and go back to doctors and are going to be willing to, I guess, continue to, you know, get their medical needs serviced online?
Oh, great question. We're asking ourselves this question about almost every business we're looking at the moment. In the case of Instant Scripts, it was a business that was created and was already thriving before COVID, before any lockdowns. And certainly there's been some tailwinds of people being more willing to try and take on remote style of services. But what we've seen is when in the Australian market, when the populations have come out of lockdown in various jurisdictions, the demand has just continued to soldier on. So we think that this business is solving an issue that is desperately wanted and needed by a really broad cross-section of the community, and COVID has probably been the thing that has accelerated them trying it out, but now they've tried it out, we're pretty confident there's going to be a lot of repeat business there.
So, Paul, you mentioned the founder, Dr. Asher, now, Frelick?
That's, yeah, he'll accept a few different answers.
Nice. And, you know, we often hear about the importance of founders, and we imagine that, you know, this is especially true in startup and growth stage companies, which we know, and you've often spoken about it. What was your process for assessing the founders of Instant Script and, you know, the executives of the team? Can you talk us through that?
Sure. I think you've touched on a good point there, that it is more than just the founder. So we spent time talking with each of the members of the senior exec team for Instant Scripts. We interacted with Asher and his right-hand man on a number of occasions, both understanding the business, then spent quite a bit of time stepping through the future business plan and the opportunities for expansion, both domestically and internationally. This might sound a little folksy, but also, you know, we had a nice long dinner together, and then we had a breakfast together, and just got to know each other, because nice. you're going to be in business in all likelihood over a number of years. And as we touched on at the beginning, things don't always go smoothly every day. And the important thing is how you deal with those speed bumps and challenges along the way. So you need to have confidence that you're dealing with someone that you can get through those hard times together. And in Dr. Frelis, we think we found a natural entrepreneur who knows his market very well. He's very passionate. He inspires his team, surrounding himself with A-graders. And so we're really pleased to be involved. We invested $5.5 million just a few months ago, and we've seen terrific progress in the business since then. And we think this is a company that definitely is an IPO candidate in due course, because we think it's something that public market investors will understand instinctively. But also we're already getting out inbound interest from players in industry.
I was going to say, it feels like a Chemist Warehouse or one of those big pharmacy chains would be a natural like acquirer of this business.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a number of, without going into too much detail today, I think there's a number of types of businesses operating in health that really are starting to see how well this is going, and they'd like to make sure that they are part of the game.
Just on the founder piece, I imagine when you make an investment, you're not the first investor that's ever come on board. So when you're assessing founders and some executives, is there like a threshold that you look at in terms of how much skin in the game or equity they have in the business for you to make an investment?
There's no hard and fast rule, but we always look at the individual, how much equity they hold, how important it is to them, who else holds the equity, what's been their track record in business previously, if they've had outside investors or if they've had business partners. And then it's all a judgment call. You know, in the case of Asher, he still holds a majority interest personally in Instant Scripts. Perennial has come on an investor at about the same time as Baylador, and we're really pleased to be partnering with those guys. Also, you know, I went back and spoke with people who had worked with Asher over his career, and I was pleased that I already knew some of those people. And it's one of the reasons David and I focus on businesses born in Australia and New Zealand. Almost every time we can find a number of people who've already worked with these founders and these teams and can give us their view. And it's just another data point that gives us that confidence.
Yeah, it is it's a fascinating company. And I think that's why we love talking to you, Paul. You're scouring Australia's startup scene and finding some really interesting businesses. We do want to talk about the startup scene a little bit later, but we want to talk about two of the other big companies in your portfolio. But before then, we're just going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. So Paul, before the ad break, I mentioned we want to talk about two of the other big businesses in your portfolio that seem to be going from strength to strength, SiteMinder and Instacluster. And SiteMinder has sort of captured headlines recently. They recently raised $100 million, and there were reports in the AFR last week that they're preparing a non-deal roadshow, suggesting that it may be preparing for an IPO. Now, I know you won't be able to tell us if they're preparing for an IPO or not, but I guess, you know, they're capturing headlines. Can you give us a bit of an update on SiteMinder? And for people that maybe haven't heard of it before, a quick 101 on what they do.
Sure. So SiteMinder is a software as a service business that serves the hotel industry. So its customers are hotels. And SiteMinder has about 35,000 hotels as customers, who pay to access the SiteMinder platform that then helps those hotels distribute their room inventory through online channels. So that's independent online travel agents like Booking.com and Expedia. There's also through channels like Ctrip, TripAdvisor, etc. So SiteMinder is the world leader in that space by some margin, and has been performing exceptionally well over a long period of time. It's previously been reported in the press that it went through a revenue of $100 million and has raised money at the last round at a valuation of over $1 billion. So that's a little snapshot of SiteMinder. In terms of how the business has gone, this is one where we were anxious at the beginning of lockdowns caused by COVID, because when your hotel base, when your customer base is hotels and people aren't traveling, there's a natural inclination to think, gee, you know, what's going to happen? But I'm really pleased to say that SiteMinder has been one of the very best performed businesses worldwide operating in the travel sector. We think it really shows the defensive qualities of the business and its importance in the ecosystem. And if you break it down, a hotel on average is paying SiteMinder somewhere around $200 a month to access the platform. That $200 is not going to be the difference between a hotel continuing to survive or not survive. But if they turn off the engine and the tap of being able to generate room bookings, then that might be the difference. And so SiteMinder plays a really important role there. So we've been very happy with how it's performed and very happy with the uptick in trade now that various parts of the world are coming out of lockdown. So we took the opportunity during lockdown to double down on product investment and to expand the number of hotels that were taking up transaction-based products from SiteMinder. So SiteMinder's introduced a payments product. It's also introduced another demand management product, which I won't go into in this forum, but basically, rather than being a fixed dollars per month, it depends on the level of volume that SiteMinder's generating. And so what that means is SiteMinder's better placed than ever to benefit as travel does pick up. And so we're super pleased with how the business and how the management team has performed.
Yeah, that's interesting. Is that what you just spoke about, is that what they raised the $100 million for, or is the $100 million going to go towards further expansion? Are you able to just talk through that?
Yeah, the company hasn't publicly talked about what they're using the $100 million for, but they have actually said it's a combination of primary and secondary, which means some of that was fresh capital, which will be used to drive growth. A big part of it's just continuing to invest in product, but some of it was secondary. So bringing on new high-quality investors for the long term and allowing some of the earlier investors to take some liquidity. And so Fidelity has joined the register, and you've had top-ups from leading names like BlackRock and Ellerston and AusSuper and Pendle, and that's really all about setting the company up for long-term and life as a public company.
So as we said, there's sort of reports been circulating that they might be preparing for an IPO. I guess a more broader question, how do you know when it's a right time for a company to go through an IPO, particularly like portfolio companies? What are you looking for, and sort of what role do you play in that?
Sure. It's a complex question. It's different for every company. One of the things that I always say to management teams when they start thinking about going public is that it's not the finish line, it's the start line. Mm. That's everything up to that point in the eyes of the public has been rehearsal. And an IPO is when you step on stage and the spotlight goes on you. So you have to be very confident in your ability to repeatedly perform. So you have to have confidence that your product's right, that your revenue is predictable. As we touched on earlier in this chat, you need to be saying things to the market that you know you're going to deliver or beat. You can't be making predictions and then fall short. And so that's really a threshold issue. In the case of SiteMinder and why now, well, SiteMinder's performed really well through lockdowns, but that's not true of every company in the travel sector, and it's not true for some of the smaller competitors around the world in SiteMinder's space. SiteMinder's a very global company. About 80% of its revenue comes from outside of Australia, and it sells into well over 100 countries. And so we think the time is really right for SiteMinder to press home its advantage, to double down on growth whilst the competitive set is perhaps a little bit weaker. And we've also identified that there are a lot of investors looking for a way to play the reopening trade. So they can see that travel is going to be picking up again, and so they're interested in how they get some exposure to that. And so a company that's high quality like SiteMinder, that's demonstrated its defensive characteristics, well, now it's time to show that it can continue to grow at those really nice rates as well. And the other factor, as always, is management. And in the case of SiteMinder, it's an A-plus management team led by Sankar Narayan, who was previously CFO and COO at Xero. And so he knows what it takes to be growing a software as a service business on a global basis from this part of the world, and he's doing a great job.
Geez, that's some pretty good pedigree to have some C-suite positions at Xero before, you know, leading your own company. So, Paul, turning to your, I guess, Bailador's thoughts on SiteMinder, you know, if it goes public, we're not saying that it will, but I imagine at some point in the future it will go public. How do you think about what Bailador will do with their shares? Do you think it's a sell and find the next expansion stage company or will it be, keep it in the portfolio and keep helping it grow?
Well, the first thing is we're big supporters of SiteMinder, as you can probably tell from the way I talk about the business. So we'll certainly hold most of our position. Having said that, SiteMinder has an outsized proportion of our portfolio. So there's a good chance that if all other things being equal, we might realize a small portion of our holding. And that just enables us to continue on our model of investing that cash in new opportunities, probably paying a frank dividend while still maintaining a really material exposure.
So, Paul, we mentioned that there were two big companies that seem to be going from strength to strength. We've touched on SiteMinder. The other one is Instacluster. So if we start at the top again, for people that aren't familiar with Instacluster, what does it do, and how's it performing through, you know, this COVID period?
Sure. So Instacluster is quite a technical business. They manage open source databases for corporates. Now, the easiest way to describe this is almost every corporate realizes the importance of data in their business and their customer interactions these days. And most corporates will use multiple types of database to manage their data, but they often don't have the resources to become a world leader in all of those types of databases. That's where a company like Instacluster comes in. Instacluster is a world leader in managing a range of particular open source databases that allow companies like Atlassian and Sonos to manipulate massive amounts of data in a very efficient and effective way. And so Instacluster, once again, very global. They've got about 90% of their revenue coming from outside of Australia. It's one of these companies where the growth has been really natural and organic and coming from word of mouth from customers who are having a great experience and recruiting other customers onto the platform. And so Instacluster just absolutely sailed through the whole COVID and lockdown situation and is producing really strong numbers. And so it's another company that has been speculated as an IPO, and it's certainly capable of IPOing, but there's multiple pathways for companies like this. Instacluster's nearest competitor out of Europe raised about $80 million at a valuation that we think it was about 25 times revenue, and we hold Instacluster at more like 6 times revenue. So we think that there's a lot of upside in our valuation, but in terms of the management and the right way to progress that business, one option is to raise some private capital and really double down on super fast growth rates. Another option is to list on the ASX. And there's a certain expectation around profitability levels, generally speaking, on the ASX. And so you still might get really healthy growth rates, sort of 40% plus, but a more profitable level. And so we're working through with the management just on what's the right option for that business. But it's just a super high quality problem to have for another really high quality management team.
Yeah, it's fascinating. When you're thinking about potential IPOs for some of your portfolio companies, and if, you know, a lot of their business is done offshore, do you ever consider listing potentially in the States?
Definitely. You know, Insta is a great example of that. it has probably a bigger presence in the US than it has in Australia, and there's quite a lot of interest from various US parties. For SiteMiner, it's slightly different. SiteMiner is actually now quite well known in the Australian institutional investment community, perhaps not retail yet because it's not a consumer-facing brand, but certainly mentioning the names that I did before, like Fidelity and BlackRock and Ellerston and so on, it already has a following. And also, if it does IPO in Australia, it will immediately be one of the top handful of tech companies on the ASX and will get a lot of attention. Whereas if it was to list on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ, it would frankly be one of hundreds that are of about that size. And so it's a lot harder to get share of voice. And so there's always factors like that to think about when you're planning out the pathway.
Yeah, well, it's a very high-class problem to have, Paul.
We couldn't be happier having those two as our two biggest holders.
Yeah.
So severely undervalued as well.
Yeah. So I guess speaking of, the fact that if SiteMinder listed on the ASX, it would be one of a handful of sort of big tech names. We do want to turn, I guess, to the smaller tech names and the private tech names and the startup ecosystem more generally. You know, you've sort of made your name at Bailador by finding some of these gems in the Australian startup ecosystem. So we'd love to get your view on, the ecosystem's health and how you think it's going more generally. So I guess if we start general, how do you assess the current state of Australia's startup scene?
It's very clearly thriving, and from a number of different angles, from the emerging success stories, from the companies that have already grown into be worth billions of dollars, to just the sheer caliber of individuals who are getting involved in startups or early stage businesses. And, in a funny sense, I think COVID and lockdown has perhaps accelerated some people's decisions to take some leaps that they otherwise had perhaps thought about and never pulled the trigger on. And so so we're definitely seeing some of that. I think these days there's a very broad awareness in the community that the tech is changing all sorts of behaviors and doing so quite quickly. That's creating investment opportunities. So there's more money flowing into the sector at all sorts of stages. That's manifesting at the moment in, frankly, pretty high valuations. And that's both in public companies in some cases, but certainly in our expansion stage, a lot of the companies that we see that are generating, say, $5 to $20 million of revenue, they look at a public comp and the values that they're trading at and say that public comp might have revenues $100 million. And they say, well, we want to be valued like that. So it comes with challenges as well. We have to be quite disciplined. We're happy to pay fair valuations, and our priority is to get the highest quality companies and the highest quality management teams as opposed to necessarily bargains. But that's kind of the dynamic as we're seeing it right now. Mm.
So, Paul, one sector that Australia does particularly well at is buy now, pay later. And it feels like every second day there's a new buy now, pay later product on the market. So I think the first part to this question is, A, are you interested in the buy now, pay later space? And then B, if not, what are some other sectors that are perhaps really exciting you at the moment?
So buy now, pay later is probably as good an example as any of where, valuations are a little bit tough to justify.
A little bit tough.
And I go right back to one of the first points. We don't believe you should invest and pay up for the assumption of perfect execution. And I think some of the valuations in that sector are kind of assuming that some of these companies go on and conquer the world. And I think clearly not all of them are going to. So I wouldn't necessarily say we're seeing hot prospects for us in that sector. But that's not to say there aren't other opportunities in fintech. We think that Australia has a track record of producing innovation more broadly in fintech. We think there's a really interesting situation where in a lot of elements of fintech, the Australian market itself is very large. And so the companies can really prove out their model and get some critical mass domestically before being forced to think more globally. And so we're interested in a number of opportunities there. Similarly in health, we've made our recent investment in Instant Scripts that we spoke about, but we see a number of emerging opportunities in healthcare. And it's a sector that perhaps hasn't fully embraced technology historically, but I think is rapidly starting to do so now.
So, Paul, you've mentioned valuations there a couple of times. I'm sure in our audience there's a number of people that are either running startups or aspire to one day run a startup. How do you think about valuing a startup? Is there like a methodology that you use when so much of the future is uncertain for so many of these businesses?
That might be a whole separate podcast.
Yeah, big question.
It's a pretty complex area to talk about because you don't necessarily have a broad suite of reliable, repeatable data. It's one of the reasons that we at Baylor focus on businesses that have at least $5 million of revenue. So you've got a little bit more chance to use fundamental valuation techniques. But it's probably a bigger topic, to be honest, Bryce and Brent.
Let's do another full topic on it then at some point. We'll put a pin in that.
We'll crack out the whiteboard and the Excel and we'll go to town.
Well, then following on from Ren's question and to close out today's interview, Paul, and we do very much appreciate you coming on as always. For those that are listening that do one day hope to start their own business and pitch to you as an investor or to other investors here in Australia, what would be your advice to them?
My advice to someone starting out, I'd say focus on solving a genuine problem with a great product. Start with that. Make your customers happy. Surround yourself with great people as you grow on the journey. Think big. But put one foot in front of the other from the beginning and just be honest. And that way, I think you'll enjoy the journey and give yourself a good chance of success.
Love it.
Well, Paul, if anyone from the Equity Mates community ever does start a business that makes it into the Baylor portfolio, we'll expect a call and the ability to participate in that round.
Find his feet.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, Paul, as always, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. As I said at the start, we often leave these conversations feeling very inspired about investing in the startup scene here in Australia, and I think that doesn't change this time around. For those listening along at home, Baylor Technology Investments is listed on the ASX. It is BTI, the ticker. So if you want to get involved in the Baylor journey and back Paul and the team, that's the way to do it. So always appreciate you coming on, Paul, and it's been fun.
Thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Paul.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Equity Mates. We love hearing from you, so drop us a line at contact@equitymates.com, or even better, go to your podcast player and leave a 5-star review. Also, a reminder that the Equity Mates content train doesn't stop when you've run out of episodes to binge. We've got a brand new website, a Facebook discussion group. We're on Instagram, YouTube, and slowly making our way as an influencer on TikTok. Well, that's Ren. So come and say hello and join the community. We'd love to welcome you. Until next time.
Equity Mates Investing Podcast is a product of Equity Mates Media. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. Equity Mates gives listeners access to information and educational content provided by a range of financial service professionals. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Equity Mates Media does not operate under an Australian financial services license and relies on the exemption available under the Corporations Act 2001 in respect of any information or advice given. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from a podcast or video. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Equity Mates website, where you can find ASIC resources and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media and the hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.